This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning, everyone. And thank you for attending the first of what we hope will be a long series of events with our partners, who we'll introduce in a moment. From Trends International and Advisory of Abu Dhabi. And to begin today, I'd like to welcome the Dean of Social Science, Melvin Oliver, to welcome you on behalf of the university and the Orfila Center. And Melvin, why don't you come up? And while he's coming up, Melvin is a quite distinguished sociologist, which one of the wonderful things for us in the school is that we actually have a dean who is a distinguished scholar and who appreciates scholarship. And I mean that in the deepest sense. And so when I told Melvin what we were doing here, one of the first things he did was to go through who we had actually invited to check and make sure that we did, in fact, have a distinguished group of scholars. And to say, I'll let him tell you what he thought of it. But Melvin, please.
You know, I do have this pleasure of welcoming guests to the campus, and this is one of the things that I enjoy. But for this group, it's pretty amazing to have a diverse a set of accomplished scholars as you to come talk about a topic that is right on our agenda every morning in the newspaper, and a conference that tries to understand and explain terrorism is certainly one of the most important kinds of things we can do as social scientists. Let me say a little bit about UCSB, because I think we have been on the locus of theory, research, and analysis on terrorism for a long time. As you know, Mark Juergensmeyer's work, and Mark was the founding director of the Orfila Center for Global and International Studies, and continuing with a host of other scholars, including Michael. It's not surprising, then, that we have this inaugural conference in our partnership with Trends as the first thing that we do. From the time I first met Dr. Burchill and learned of the vision and goals of Trends, I was confident that partnership with Trends would really be mutually beneficial. The social sciences in general at UCSB are committed to developing theory and uncovering new data that illuminates the underlying foundations of pressing social issues. We're committed to proposing and testing the many alternative futures that social policy could take to address complex and vexing problems. That is why I think this partnership with Trends can be very, very successful. We dovetail so nicely with the ultimate goals of Trends, which, as its president and founder, who you'll hear from very soon, Dr. Ahmed Al-Hamali notes, it is to present policy alternatives that serve all, that transform societies and improve the living standards of humanity. Now, I look forward to this as the beginning of many cooperative endeavors, and I want to publicly express our thanks to Trends as a partner in our joint enterprise going forward. Now, another aspect of UCSB that characterizes this conference is a strong commitment to interdisciplinarity. This conference is a perfect example of that commitment. What an amazing collection of outstanding scholars from multiple fields and disciplines. Scholars from sociology to political science, from communication to criminology, from psychology to religious studies, and from history to law. It's only from these multiple perspectives and diverse methods that we will have our best opportunity to not only understand the various constructions of terrorism, but to also discover the strategies and policies that can effectively address the underlying conditions that precipitate it. Let me end by thanking the director of the Orfila Center, Dr. Michael Stoll, for his outstanding leadership and developing the partnership with Trends and his vision in helping to conceptualize with Trends this marvelous gathering. I look forward to a productive and engaging conference. I thank you for being in Santa Barbara for a couple of days, but I know that's a gig that's not too hard to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melvin, and I think you can see what I meant about supportive. It is now my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ahmed Alhamli, the president and founder of Trends Research and Advisory, and to thank him right here in up front for seeking me out to participate in the inaugural event in terms of Trends history. That happened a year ago, December, and that's when our conversations about potential partnerships actually began. And what's interesting about Dr. Ahmed is that he has an interesting scholarly background as well. Dr. Ahmed earned his PhD in public law at the University of Hull, where he investigated the interaction between Islam, democracy, and human rights. And he is deeply committed to those purposes, and it was his vision which made this his organization possible, but also which attracted me to say this is a partner that we can work with and work with well. And so I very much appreciate that. And Dr. Ahmed, I invite you please to welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our event, Construction of Terrorism. I wish to thank Dean Oliver for his kind words and for joining us today. Trends Research and Advisory is proud to be partner with Orfila Center, and we are very pleased to be cooperating with Michael and the center in organizing this event. The ideas of this project first came about when Michael was invited to Abu Dhabi for an event we hosted on the rise of extremism in the Middle East. In our discussion, we found that while we were all using the same word terrorism, we were actually not sure of what we were describing. Was any use of violence the same as terrorism? When an individual carries out a horrific crime, is that terrorism? There is clearly much that needs to be done to understand what we are talking about. Terrorism itself, as we know, is not new. The use of violence and the pursuit of political goals has been a constant challenge for society. Over the last 50 years or so, it appears the problem is getting worse. Getting worse in terms of the tactics used and the intensity of death and destructions caused. Even if in absolute terms, the violence we are experiencing is no greater than the societies have experienced in the past. The insecurity and fear it creates needs to be addressed. It appears that terrorists are succeeding in creating fear in our society and around the world. In response to the source of this fear, we see reaction and operations undertaken by local, national, and international authorities. We have to ask, are these responses suitable for dealing with the problem? It is well known, I hope, that security responses to terrorist activity is not enough. We have to deal with the core causes of extremism which lead to terrorist activity. In both cases, however, we have to understand what we are dealing with and ensure our responses are appropriate. It appears that our responses are confused and uncoordinated due to divergent understandings, leading to ineffective responses. It is hoped that through this project, we can begin to develop frameworks for more effective strategies in dealing with the act of extremism. The recent attacks in Beirut, Paris, and Bamako, along with the ongoing security operations around the world, make clear that our tools for understanding and dealing with terrorists remain limited. Our tools and approaches are limited due to gap in our understanding and knowledge about terrorism and the activities of terrorists. Or even when we have extensive knowledge, it appears we struggle to apply it effectively, again, due to gap of knowledge and understanding. The causes and sources of extremism and terrorism are both local and global. We cannot separate the two. Our understanding of the construction of terrorism, along with responses, need to integrate understandings that cover all levels of society. We have to understand local context, but we also have to work to assist others in understanding local conditions. At the same time, while we attempt to understand the local, we have to be aware of and knowledge about the global environment. In trying to understand terrorism, we face many challenges. Extremist views and the use of terrorism have no specific political, religious, or cultural sources. No society or country is immune either. Understanding how terrorism is constructed, we need knowledge and expertise shared among academics, policymakers, and societies from around the world. We hope this event is the start of that process. Once again, I would like to thank everyone for participating and joining us this morning. And I would like to extend my thanks to California University Santa Barbara and the Orfila Center for organizing this event. And I look forward to our discussion. Thank you very much.
So before we move on to our first presenter, I have a few thanks I need to do as appropriate, in addition to thanking TRENDS for their cooperation. Let me introduce Richard Burchill, the research director at TRENDS, who will be co-hosting with me in terms of the formal part of the program. Scott Englund, what happened to Scott? For the participants, who has been the person most responsible for interacting with you and putting together materials. I'd also like to recognize Victor Fassel in the back, who is responsible for a lot of the detailed administrative arrangements, and I've already had some very nice comments about the food we ordered. So thank you, Victor. As an army moves on its stomach, so do scholars, apparently. And I'd like to thank Ben Smith, who's sitting in the back of the room, who's responsible for all the web-related activities, as well as being a participant, who you'll hear from later today. Okay. So when we begin, we will have... not quite the normal style of presentation. We're not jamming everybody together on the stage at one time with four papers or three papers in a row and then a very brief set of discussions. Rather, each presenter will present for approximately 15 to 20 minutes, and then the rest of each session will be devoted to a participation by us in the room in terms of discussing and building upon the conversation that begins with the first paper and hopefully carries through all the way. We have assembled, as has been pointed out, I think quite a distinguished group of people. And to try to set the stage, I want to begin with two studies that are about a decade old, which studied the literature on terrorism and had some conclusions about the state of that literature at the time. Most people they found who studied terrorism have been consistently, over the last 40 years, new to the subject. Most of the publications that have come out on terrorism, and as you'll see, not by the people in this room, but most of the publications that have come out on terrorism in the vast literature, and at one count there are more than 20,000 of them in the last couple of decades, of those 20,000, 83% were written by somebody for whom that was the only contribution they have ever made in the study of terrorism. Okay, so what's happened is an event happens, you can spike it, you can see the trends. An event happens shortly thereafter, in scholarly terms. A set of articles appear, people get interested in terrorism, and then they've told everybody what needs to be done, they figured out the problem, and they move on, because it's no longer, in fact, interesting to them. Most of those articles don't actually invest time in figuring out what others have done before them. Don't investigate the literature across disciplines very well. And there's not a lot of work that, in fact, results in theory building or explanations that tie together information from other fields in terms of, for example, just things that might be obvious to you. Political violence studies, for example, very rarely in general appear in the terrorism literature. The study of revolution very rarely appears in the terrorism literature in terms of, again, in terms of this percentage of studies. And so the result, if you go back and you look not only 10 years ago, but if you look 30 years ago, you have the following statement from Alex Schmidt and Bertolt Jungmann in their compendium of terrorism studies up till that point in time. 80% of the research that was done, it's not looking at authors, but rather simply 80% of the research that's published was not research-based in any rigorous sense. Much of the writing is impressionistic, superficial, and at the same time also pretentious, reaching far greater generalizations on the basis of episodal evidence than could ever be justified. And there are numerous other critiques that arise each decade indicating the same thing. The scholars here that we've assembled are very, very different. They're not only quite distinguished in their own fields, but they're also quite distinguished amongst the community of scholars of terrorism. Almost everyone that is going to participate and present has spent a good deal of their career, in fact, studying terrorism. And many have devoted a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, and even more to the study of terrorism. As Melvin indicated, we come from a variety of backgrounds, and that's not an accident. That was intended, that was purposeful. While many of us know each other, we wanted to actually present in the same place at the same, have them present same place at the same time, so that we could have some pretty good arguments, I hope. Of course, pleasant. And while we construct the problems differently, I assure you, we have very different, at least up until today, as far as I know, we have, based on my knowledge of everyone's writing, we have very different ideas about terrorism, about policy responses, necessarily the importance of talking about it. We don't believe that there is a one-size-fits-all explanation. We don't believe there's a one-size-fits-all policy response. And that I know is clear. So the next 2 days should be quite interesting. I'm looking forward to what each of the contributors have to say about their own work, and most importantly, as I want to stress again, what we have to say to each other. And I hope that the audience that are not the presenters will also feel that they can contribute and participate. And we look not only for your questions, but your ideas. The only thing I'll ask of all of us is that we don't make long speeches, but rather that we engage in a dialogue. So I want to say that Richard and I are going to split the day in terms of being the moderator for the events today and tomorrow. I have brought with me, the normal scholarly thing about we all run over. So I will give each of you a yellow card warning when you have 3 minutes left, and of course the red card when it's time to sit down. Okay, and
where's the card for more Churrascaria?
Excuse me.
Do we get thrown out of the conference?
You don't get. You have to go to the sideline though. Okay. So with that, let me introduce our first speaker. Actually, before I do that, just to give you a hint, if any of you want to get a cup of coffee now, why don't you do that? And let's try to limit our movement around during the presentations and throughout the day, get our coffee, et cetera, which will be available all day at the times in the obvious breaks, okay? No big jumps up. Let me introduce our first speaker, Lisa Stampitsky, and Lisa, please. We have detailed biographies in the program, so I'm not taking the time to give everybody a long introduction. In fact, that was rather short. Thank you.
Oh, I was just going to say, can I just bring that up here? Thank you. Oops. Wait, how do I go back? Sorry. Okay. All right. So thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me go first, set the tone. I have what I think will maybe be a bit of a provocation and hopefully will be good to open up some discussion. So I've titled this talk, Can Terrorism Be Defined? But of course, you know, this that's sort of provocative, right? And I would say it's also probably not the best way to ask the question. Because of course terrorism can be defined, right? The problem is not a lack of definitions. It's not a surfeit of definitions, but a surplus of definitions. And what I want to suggest is that the more apt question is not whether terrorism can be defined or even how should it be defined, but how is it actually defined in practice? And you know, as you, if you're familiar with my work, you know that's what I have focused on in my work. What I want to focus on today, though, is I want to sort of introduce this notion that we should think about terrorism as it's defined in practice, meaning the actions taken primarily but not exclusively by the state in response to terrorism or in the name of counterterrorism. And what I want to suggest is that we can derive a definition in practice by looking at what is responded to as part of the terrorism problem. You know, so at the moment, this would be primarily those things that are encompassed within the war on terror. And more broadly, what I would suggest is that rather than looking at struggles over definition, which I will talk about, you know, which are omnipresent, as we've already heard, I want to suggest that we start instead by looking at practices and struggles over practices, that is, the actions that are taken to combat what is called terrorism, and that we can thus derive, in a sense, a definition in reverse by identifying those people, actions, sites, and so forth that are subjected to the practices of counterterrorism. All right, so I began by referencing this problem of definition in terrorism studies, characterized by what I've called a surplus of definitions and the lack of agreement on any one definition. And in fact, it goes beyond this, because the definitions that are circulating are often not just different, but mutually contradictory. So for example, there are definitions that state that states can commit terrorism. There are definitions that specifically state that states cannot commit terrorism. There are definitions that would say that terrorism is only violence against civilians. Others will have a definition that will say that terrorism can be violence against civilians and against others. And examples of these contradictions are easy to find, not just in abstract debates over definition, but also in the application of the label in practice. So, for example, many will criticize the U.S. for having double standards, pointing to U.S. support for terrorists, right, sort of violent insurgents who target civilians, right, sort of such as in the past, support for the Contras in Nicaragua, RENAMO in southern Africa, or even support for Osama bin Laden and his Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan in the 1980s, while condemning the violence of those that it deems enemies. And as the saying goes, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Right? So I'm going to just, you know, sort of the slides here, I've just got illustrations here that you see, you know, sort of people pointing out these contradictions. But the thing is, I want to say, is that it goes deeper than that. It's not just that there's disagreement over how the label should be defined or how it should be, what the definition should be. It's that there is no settled answer to what terrorism is. Some argue that the term has become so expansive as to be almost meaningless. In fact, what I've argued in my book is that even terrorism experts haven't been able to agree on how terrorism should be defined. You know, so when I did interviews with experts, they themselves often lamented this problem of definition, as they've done in print. You know, so just to give you one example of this, I spoke to Brian Jenkins, who was the founder of terrorism research at RAND, and he said to me, definitional debates are the great Bermuda Triangle of terrorism research. I've seen entire conferences go off into definitional debates, never to be heard from again. So hopefully that won't happen to us today, but you know, it's just a warning. All right, so again, you know, sort of we've got another, you know, image that this has been circulating. Unfortunately, the past couple of weeks have provided more and more examples for these debates. And I've sort of been adding, you know, sort of to this paper, everything that's been happening, you know, just in the last month, there's more and more incidents, right? So this is another image that was circulating, you know, sort of making fun of the fact that it seems like in practice in the US, right, sort of terrorism label gets defined based on the color of your skin. Now, as I've already suggested, right, sort of with these quotes and with these images, you know, many, you know, by no means all, terrorism experts are highly disconcerted by this situation, by this problem of definition, and have sought, however, with relatively little success, to fix or to stabilize the definition of terrorism, often suggesting that until this is accomplished, little progress can be made in the field. As I've discussed in my previous work, people often point to the politicization of the concept as a key hindrance. So, for example, Martha Crenshaw has written that the task of definition necessarily involves transforming terrorism into a useful analytical term rather than a polemical tool, right? So you have this common contrast between, right, the politicized definition and the analytic definition. And what you often have is a desire, right, sort of to extract the political and say, can we come up with actually a defensible analytical definition? Furthermore, you know, so I only have 15 minutes, so I'm not going to go on and give you more examples, but I'm sure you're all familiar with these sorts of debates that go on. Furthermore, you know, this problem of definition doesn't just trouble experts, right? Sort of as I suggest by having this cartoon up here. Media coverage of terrorism as well is frequently characterized by disputes over definition. Critiques of the conceptualization of terrorism in the media tend to highlight inconsistencies in the use of the term, particularly pointing out seeming double standards, right, where the term is applied to one set of actors but not another who engage in seemingly similar acts. So to give just one example from, you know, sort of a set of critiques that appeared in the media this past summer after the massacre of 9 churchgoers at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. And an article appeared on Salon.com and stated as follows. As many have pointed out, the media is unsure about what constitutes terrorism only when white people are the perpetrators. White men with guns are lone wolves or mentally ill or depraved criminals. Brown men with bombs are very obviously terrorists. This is a double standard with consequences. Terrorism is a word that resonates. It inspires urgency and collective action, both of which are needed if we're to deal with the underlying problems. If white people can't, by definition, be terrorists, then the term has no practical meaning. It's about the actor, not the act. If terrorism is something only brown people do, then we should be honest and admit that. We should say that terrorism is about the color of the criminal, not the intent of the crime. Right, so in sum, there is significant contestation over the conceptualization of terrorism, both among experts and the media, right? Sort of in contrast to some who would say, you know, sort of, oh, this discourse is just, you know, sort of comes down from above by the state, you know, sort of it's clear that there is a lot of contestation over the meaning and a lot of criticism. These debates tend to hinge on concerns that the concept of terrorism is either inherently ambiguous or that it's applied inconsistently. In other words, that there are double standards. Ultimately, what I want to suggest is that many of these criticisms come down to making the point that the concept needs to be fixed in two senses of the word, right? Fixed in the sense, first, that it's broken. It needs to be repaired. We need to come up with a more coherent definition that needs to be applied in a more consistent way. But also that it needs to be fixed in a second sense. Fixed in the sense that it's wobbly and we need to stabilize it, right? Sort of that we need to be prevent it from being continually politicized and biased, right? That you'll see that, you know, sort of experts will propose or, you know, sort of others will propose definitions that seem coherent, that seem that they would work analytically, but yet, you know, sort of once they get out there, they are politicized and don't stay stabilized. But what I want to suggest is that these critiques, while they are themselves valid, are insufficient. And the difficulty I want to suggest with this project of fixing the concept, and perhaps one reason why I would argue it has yet to succeed, is that the politicization of the concept of terrorism is not primarily a corruption of an otherwise neutral term. In which case, the solution would be simply to purify it, to remove the bias and the politicization. The separation of these core external essential bits of the meat concept from the extraneous, pasted on, politicized pieces, which bias it in one direction or another. Instead, I want to suggest that the political is baked into the concept from the start. What do I mean by this? I mean that the primary constitution of terrorism occurs through the actions of the state, encountering what it treats as terrorism as a practical problem through the practices of counterterrorism or the current war on terror. And that this drive to resolve the problem of definition follows from the seeming inconsistencies in these practices and in the discourses around them. Rather, however, from the existence of a set of terrorist acts in the world, or from, you know, sort of the discourses about them, both in the activities of experts and the state and of popular meaning makers. In other words, what I want to suggest is that without counterterrorism, there really is no terrorism, right? Not that there are not violent acts, you know, of course, but that the category itself stems from the practice of counterterrorism. And subsequently, that any attempt to purify the concept of terrorism, which would entail an attempt to tear the concept away from the practical realm of counterterrorism, which is not, you know, sort of analytically consistent in this sense, is likely to encounter difficulty once it re-enters any practical engagement with the practical realm, as the political construction of terrorism through practice will then act back upon the momentarily purified analytical concepts that experts and others will introduce. Right, so again, you know, so we have here this sort of a satirical chart that was circulated in 2002 suggesting that the US government treats all of these sorts of categories of people as terrorists in practice. So what I want to suggest here then is that the core logic of the identification of terrorism in practice, you know, sort of how should we think about that? What, you know, I want to suggest is that what the logic that runs through it that brings together what is treated as terrorism in practice, at least in the US, is that it's violence out of place. And so the question then is, what counts as out of place, right? So, you know, sort of we've heard politicians say, and, you know, sort of an interview with the writer Arun Kundani, he recently brought this again to the fore. He said, the promise of the war on terror was that we would kill them over there so that they would not kill us over here. And in a sense, I think that actually gets to something, right? Sort of that there's this sense that, you know, sort of there are certain places where we expect violence to be happening, but then once it moves out of those places, then it becomes terrorism. So even if you think of, right, sort of the recent attacks in Paris, right, sort of, you know, sort of there's continual violence of this sort, bombings, attacks on civilians, and so forth in the territory, you know, sort of in Syria, in Iraq, that's held by ISIS. But when does it become something that is of concern to the whole world? When do you have the leaders of the free world, Hollande, Obama, and so forth, you know, standing up and saying, this is a threat to civilization? It's when the violence moves out of the war zone and to Paris, right, to the cafes and to, you know, concert halls and places where we expect that there shouldn't be this sort of violence. It's violence out of the places where, you know, not that it's okay for it to be happening in Syria, but that it's expected there in a sense, and that it's in the wrong place when it happens in a concert hall in Paris. So, you know, it's violence out of place. On a site that's perceived in some way innocent or perceived as disconnected from explicit political causes or actions, I can expand on this. And that, you know, sort of there may be something if those attacked are seen as generalizable, representative of the population as whole, or even of the state. And there's something here, I think, that might explain why sometimes even attacks on military might be understood by the state as terrorism. Because if you attack, it's an attack on, right, sort of there have been a number of, you know, sort of incidents that people famously point to as this is an inconsistency, you know, sort of attacks on soldiers. soldiers at a military base, but if it's representative as of an attack on the state as a whole, that there's something that resonates there. Anyway, so I don't have time to sort of develop a whole theory of, right, sort of what, you know, sort of what is this? What is the analysis of what terrorism in practice looks like? But rather, I want to introduce this idea that, right, sort of this is sort of an alternative methodology or epistemology for thinking about what the definition of terrorism is. How, right, sort of if this is this argument that I'm suggesting or a provocation I'm putting forward, how might we attest or evaluate this? I would suggest that we can evaluate it by analyzing whether this applies not just to incidents which are treated in the end as terrorism, but also by analyzing which sites and populations and groups are treated as subject to practices of counterterrorism, right? Sort of does this idea of violence over place, out of place, seem to apply to what gets treated as terrorism. So I'll just give sort of a couple of further anecdotes or illustrations that I hope will further support what I'm saying here. So I'm saying that, you know, terrorism in practice is violence out of place. So one illustration here is the emergence of the contemporary concept of terrorism itself. And what I've argued is that the emergence of the contemporary concept of terrorism began to take shape in the 1970s. And over the course of that decade, understandings of political violence, including hijackings, assassinations, and other acts that we now call terrorism, but which of course pre-existed the 1970s, shifted from being understood primarily through a discourse of insurgency in the United States, in which violence was understood to be rational, purposeful, sometimes even justifiable, to a discourse dominated by the concept of terrorism, in which such acts were in some ways understood as irrational and fundamentally immoral. Furthermore, at that time, the problem of terrorism came to be understood as rooted in a terrorist identity rather than as a tactic that any group might adopt. And this identity came to almost contain its own explanation, that terrorists are evil, irrational actors whose actions are driven not by normal interests or political motives, but by their identity as terrorists, right? And so then you get the, you know, sorts of cartoons like the one I put up, you know, sort of critiquing the notion that in practice terrorism is defined by the person who's doing it rather than the sort of act that it involves. So I've argued that there's a crucial turning point that dates to the early 1970s when people first started to talk about terrorism in this way and when terrorism became a problem for the US government. And this dates to the rise of a seemingly new sort of political theatrical violence exemplified by the media-centric hijackings and hostage takings perpetrated by Palestinian nationalists. While, as I've said, right, political violence against civilians, of course, was not new. What was new here was that nationalist and anti-colonial violence transgressed political and geographical boundaries in new ways. Whereas nationalist violence had previously largely been happening, you know, sort of in the sites under contestation, right? So you had lots of violence and attacks against civilians, for example, in the, you know, sort of nationalist uprisings in Algeria. But what happened in the 1970s is that this violence moved out of place, moved from, right, sort of the colonial or the post-colonial arena to international arenas and began to target Americans and other Westerners, both as direct victims and as an intended media audience. And it did this by striking at transnational sites like the Olympics and like international air travel. And this is what I mean by violence out of place. Now, all right, I'm almost out of time. Just a couple of final points, right? One is that the problem of definition was present almost from the start, right? As you're probably aware, there were attempts, for example, throughout the course of the 1970s to develop international agreements on how to counter terrorism in the UN, and these faltered over the insistence of countries from the global south that violence in the course of nationalist uprisings should be excluded. This is just one example of the difficulty, the problem of definition. But this doesn't mean that there wasn't a definition or, you know, sort of multiple definitions, because it changes over time in practice, meaning that, right, sort of what is treated as terrorism is the definition in practice. And of course, this changes over time, and this will vary by state, right? Sort of the definition in practice of terrorism in the U.S. is going to be different from the different definition in practice in India or in Saudi Arabia. But there is, you know, sort of a definition, I would argue, in practice, that what is treated as terrorism or the groups and sites that are treated as sort of potential sites to be regulated as sites of counterterrorism, that that is the definition in practice. And that because, you know, sort of this definition in practice doesn't, it's not organized according to the sort of analytical logic of, you know, sort of a set definition of the sort that social scientists like to use, or that, you know, sort of people observing, you know, sort of media critics who would like to have, you know, sort of a set definition, this is why we get these attempts to criticize it and to fix it. But that, the, you know, sort of what I want to suggest is that we can't, in a sense, or, you know, sort of it's going to be very, like, difficult to just fix the definition of terrorism by making a better definition. You know, because there is sort of this ongoing back and forth process that any sort of better, you know, sort of or more coherent definition, once it enters the public sphere, is going to interact with the definition in practice and be, right, sort of tainted by it in some sense. You know, and I'm not saying that we can't come up with definitions of terrorism and you know, sort of use them to talk about it and analyze it, but that, you know, sort of that there's going to be this continual resistance or pushback or repoliticization due to the different sort of logic of the definition of terrorism, as I've called it, in practice. So that is, you know, perhaps a pessimistic opening to the day when we're hoping to figure out how to construct terrorism, but that's what I've been thinking about recently. So thank you. And did it have any more? Oh, sorry. Yeah, let us begin by. All right, so thanks a lot. Should I sit down? Or?
All right, folks, we'll get started if we can, please. Just briefly, as Michael said, my name is Richard, Director of Research and Engagement at Trends, and personally, I just want to thank everybody for coming. Certainly appreciate you being here, and are we looking forward to what we got? Right, following on from Lisa's opening remarks, pleasure to introduce John Mueller from Ohio State University on overestimating terrorism and a true sense of interdisciplinary work. John's obviously an expert on terrorism, but also on Fred Astaire and dance as well. So we got a great perspective coming in. John, floor is yours. Thanks.
I'll try to avoid the temptation to break into a tap dance here. Well, the floor is, you know. My background mostly is in international relations, and also got interested particularly in international war, and then also civil war, which would be somewhat relevant to the talk. And after 9/11, I got much more interested in terrorism, but I didn't really have to define it because I wasn't all that interested in terrorism, but basically in counterterrorism. So all I had to do is basically find out what the counterterrorists were doing and accept their definition for it. So I didn't really have to work very hard to sort of put that in order. After 9/11, but in many respects, even after 9/11, terrorism still hasn't really entered international relations literature a lot. You know, people like John Mearsheimer say, "You're really afraid of the underwear bomber? You know, that's a security threat." What I've been doing lately is we've done two books with Mark Stewart on trying to evaluate counterterrorism expenditures. The first one mostly on protection measures, and one is just out, like today practically, called Chasing Ghosts, the Policing of Terrorism, dealing with policing countermeasures, intelligence counterterrorism measures in the United States. And part of that is I sort of had to deal a little bit more thoroughly with terrorism and the definition. And what I'd like to do is sort of make just three points. One is dealing with which I think tend to exaggerate the importance of terrorism. I still sort of believe, like I did before 9/11, that it isn't all that important a phenomenon, and it's been rather inflated in importance since 9/11 in particular. But one is definitional. The second is dealing with the tendency to exaggerate terrorist capacities. And the third is basically arguing that terrorism really doesn't make all that much difference frequently if it's defined in the way I want to define it in terms of international history. Okay, let me begin with the first issue, which is the definition of terrorism. After 9/11, of course, everything became terrorism. Turns out the Israelis were fighting terrorists, and the Chinese were fighting terrorists, and the Russians were fighting terrorists, and basically it got filtered over very heavily into civil war, which is my main point on this. If you use a sort of standard definitions, like the Global Terrorism Database definition, this is the definition they use from the recent book about terrorism in context. Most commentators agree on several key elements captured in the definition we use here. The threatened or actual use of illegal force and violence by non-state actors to attain a political, economic, religious, or social goal through fear, coercion, or intimidation. Michael Stoll is very much on that same wavelength. He calls it the purposeful act or the threat of the act of violence to create fear or compliant behavior, a phrase I like a lot, compliant behavior, in a victim and or the audience of the act or threat. My problem is this, basically coming from having looked at war a lot, is that's basically the same definition as war. Clausewitz, sort of the classic theorist about war, said that wars are basically breaking the will of the enemy, doing stuff that causes them to no longer want to fight, and then you win. And so if you want a compliant behavior, the compliant behavior looking forward to in war is surrender or something like that. And so consequently, the as one questioner just brought up just recently, the conflation, it seems to me, of war and terrorism is a real problem in many respects. What I would generally propose looking at is looking at terrorism in terms of its frequency. And it seems to me, this is basically following what Mao Zedong said, how do you do wars? Well, you start out by sort of establishing a base someplace. Then you do terrorism, which is sabotage, shooting, killing, assassination, and keeping the enemy very much off balance. Then the third, that's a second stage. Then the third stage is you go to sort of classic conventional war. That you don't necessarily always have to go to the third level, but it seems to me that there's a quantitative difference between between warfare and terrorism. Terrorism is breaking things and killing people, but it's sporadic. And once it ceases being sporadic in an area, we no longer call it terrorism, at least that was the case before 9/11 in particular. What we do is we call it insurgency or civil war. And you could see that, it seems to me, very clearly in the Iraq War. Initially, what was happening is everybody's being called terrorists. But within 2 or 3 years, the American military stopped calling them terrorists and said they're insurgents. And I think that's correct. So the difference then is not targeting and all that kind of stuff. Insurgents in civil wars become, at some quantitative point, the frequency of terrorism becomes bad enough, frequent enough, so that you no longer call it terrorism. And that's what I'd like to propose as a sort of minimalist definition of terrorism. And I think that's what basically was the case before 9/11. So what you get is the Irish Republican Army, for example, always was a terrorist group. It had political goals. It was trying to get something out of the government, and it was using violence to do so. It was trying to get compliant behavior from the government, but it never was continuous enough to be considered an insurgency. I don't know anybody's ever called it an insurgency. Maybe they did, but not as far as I know. On the other hand, in Sri Lanka, there was basically terrorist activity being carried out, but fairly quickly it became an insurgency, or it's called a civil war. So the problem, if you don't do that, and if you buy my line of reasoning, is that if you call what's going on in Iraq terrorism, or Syria terrorism, you have to redefine every civil war in history, practically, as being, the whole category will fall out of favor. You can't call, there aren't civil wars anymore, there aren't insurgencies, there's only terrorism. And so if you keep that definition the way it is now, non-state actors using violence, you have to redefine virtually every civil war. So consequently, if you want to deal with trends, what you have to do is go back, for example, to Algeria in the 1990s. That's always called a civil war. But, you know, they're using massacres, they're using blowing, they're controlling certain territory and intimidation and so forth to try to get a political settlement. There's a real purpose to it. It wasn't random and it wasn't criminal. So I'd like to advance that as a way of sort of looking at the thing. And it means basically that if you're dealing with trends, if you look at civil wars, there's been a real decline, not an increase, of civil wars. I did a book on this called Remnants of War. In the early 1990s, there were about 19 civil wars going on in the world. In this century, there's usually been 4 or 5 or 6. That may be a bit on the increase because of Syria, and it's also on an increase in terms of sheer damage being done in places like Syria. But nonetheless, it's much smaller than it used to be. So if you want to do time trends, you have to really go back and reclassify every civil war previously as having used terrorism. You may not have to include genocide, for example, in Rwanda, but you certainly have to indicate that everything that was done by the insurgents in Bosnia, for example, was terrorism. Because they were trying to get a goal by using force and violence. But no one ever, it was basically seemed to be a civil war. Let me put that. Another way of looking at it is a classic thing that word that hasn't come up now so far, is terrorism is the weapon of the weak. That fits where I look at it really nicely. You may not agree, obviously, but you do terrorism because you can't do war. However, terrorists that get organized enough eventually are doing what used to be called civil war. And it's a quantitative thing, when the frequency of these the same kind of behavior. And I'm not sure where that number is. I'd like to, my co-author, Mark Stewart, likes numbers a lot, and I told him, figure out the number. So far, it hasn't happened, but it is there. Let me add also, but it's someplace. And you could probably do it with the GTT, since, you know, as Laura pointed out, you can parse the thing, and you've got all these, you know, only deal with certain kinds of incidents, but there's probably a case where you could show it in the Iraq War when terrorism became so frequent that you'd say, well, now it's insurgency. Anyway, that's the way I would look at it. One final point on that. In the case of ISIS, it seems absurd to call it a terrorist organization. It's an insurgency. It's trying to control territory. It's fighting pitched battles. It's using blowing up stuff, like blowing up civilians and so forth, is part of the strategy, but that is not remotely new. So in that area, basically what you got is, it seems to me, an insurgency going on. On the other hand, I'm not sure how I want to work this out, but on the other hand, the question about attacking France. Now, if it were a real state, and the French were involved in a war with your neighbors, and the French came in on one side, you might declare war on France. But ISIS is weak in that sense. It can't do it. So what it does is encourage terrorism as a way. So in some respects, it's both a terrorist organization and a non-terrorist organization. It might be worked out there. Also, if you follow that line of reasoning, the whole issue of international war becomes a problem. Because in all international wars, virtually, a fair number of civilians are killed. There's a few where there, you know, very few where not very many people got killed, civilians got killed. For example, World War I, only 9 million people were killed, and the vast majority of them were young men in uniform, so it must be a really great war, because not we weren't killing civilians. But if you're using it, bombing of Hiroshima and so forth, what you're trying to do is intimidate the leaders in Japan to give up. So you keep punishing them and punishing them and punishing them, and eventually they snap. Now, they tend to snap at a rather low level in some respects. I did a study basically looking at the percentage in international wars and colonial wars, the percentage of the pre-war population that died in battle deaths before the war ended. And it tended to be usually under 1%. So what happens is, for example, in World War II, for the Germans and the Russians, the Soviet Union got up to about 3%. 3% of the pre-war population died in battle deaths. That's not civilian deaths, but soldier deaths in those two countries before they, in this case, the Germans, quit. They broke. In the case of the Japanese in World War II, it was about 1.5%. So it's not like wars are annihilation. They don't kill everybody in the population. They kill, 1.2%, 1.5% is not small, but it's not the whole population by any means. So it seems to me that in that case, what you're doing is trying to break the will of the enemy. In the case of Vietnam, the United States was trying to break the will of the enemy. It's called the search for the breaking point. How much punishment can they take? It turns out they could take a lot of punishment because they took about 3%, 2.5% of the pre-war population died. But nevertheless, there was a breaking point, but it was, of course, the United States that broke. But in either case, it was that kind of dynamic. Okay, so that's point one, so the definitional one. Second point is there tends to be an exaggeration overall of the capacities of terrorists. I've done a study, which is an online book, in which we looked at all the terrorists, would-be terrorists in the United States since 9/11, who are a Muslim terrorist. Anybody who's tried to commit or seems to have been trying to commit terrorism in the United States, whether they're based in the United States itself or abroad. So we include the underwear bomber and things like that. And one of the things in the case studies we did in the book, which the book is called Terrorism Since 9/11, The American Cases, I asked the people, mostly honor students at Ohio State, to tell me what these people were like. And so this section of the nature of the adversary or whatever. But if you look at what the Department of Homeland Security says about terrorism, it's quite a bit different. Let me give you their position first. They've done a study basically talking about who the adversary is. They say the terrorist attacks are proven to be relentless, patient, opportunistic, and flexible, learning from experience and modifying tactics and targets to exploit perceived vulnerabilities and avoid observed strengths. When I asked the students to do the same thing, what are these guys like? These are the kinds of words that came up. They were not words like patient, opportunistic, flexible, and relentless, but incompetent, ineffective, unintelligent, idiotic, ignorant, inadequate, unorganized, misguided, muddled, amateurish, dopey, realistic, moronic, irrational, foolish, and gullible. Obviously, even knuckleheads can do damage, like the guy just in San Bernardino. Over and over again, you get these guys are really amazingly incompetent, and there's a tendency to avoid that, which also seems to increase the fear of terrorism, because you get the idea that these guys are all Moriartys or something like that. Now, there's one way, by my definition, in which terrorism could become a big deal, and that's if terrorists were able to do a lot of 9/11s. In other words, if 9/11 had been a harbinger rather than an aberration, then they would still be sporadic violence, but it would be massively bigger than typically happens with terrorism. And the big fear after 9/11, of course, was that because they're so good with box cutters, Al-Qaeda would soon come up with nuclear weapons. So we're still waiting for that to happen. Did a book on that called Atomic Obsession, suggesting that their chances of doing so were pretty near vanishing. And 9/11 still, it should be pointed out, 9/11 still stands out big time. There's never been a terrorist attack in history, inside war zones or outside war zones, in which that visited even one-tenth as much destruction, death and physical destruction. So it's an extreme outlier. There's 9/11, and then 90% down, there's the next case. So it's my definition, it seems to hold, assuming 9/11 doesn't become common. And of course, some people are worried about that with with ISIS and so forth. And then finally, the third point has to do with what has terrorism accomplished? If you define it my way, which is to separate it out from insurgencies. Insurgencies do have an impact. They do change, they sometimes win and so forth. It seems to me that the terrorism, generally speaking, has had very little historical impact. There's two areas where terrorism by itself, not as an insurgency, but terrorism by itself has actually had fairly big impact. One of these is assassination. which I'm not very questionable that I want to call that terrorism, but assassinating John Kennedy probably did have an effect on the Vietnam War. It's a historical debate. Assassinating Rabin in Israel almost certainly did have an effect of fairly more important, considerable importance on Israeli policy. So sometimes assassinations can do it. The other time when terrorism can do it is when it is when it's applied against an enemy that has A, a low tolerance for casualties, and B, very low stakes in the issue. So for example, when 283 Marines were killed in Lebanon, that was discussed a little bit earlier, the United States pulled out of Lebanon. It basically said, what we're doing here is not very important. It's certainly not worth 283 people. They pulled out, Reagan pulled them out, and he was reelected handily the next year, or later in the same year, when he actually, the year he pulled them out. Similarly, when 19 Americans were killed in a firefight, which might be considered a form of terrorism, in 1993 in Somalia, the United States pulled out. And the reason was, you know, why are we wasting American lives trying to save these people? They want to kill us. So there's very low evaluation of the stakes. There's purely humanitarian, no national security stakes, it seemed, and a very low tolerance for any kind of casualties in a humanitarian venture. Similarly, the Zionist terrorism against the British in Israel, in the process of forming Israel, the British really didn't want to get into a fight over this chunk of territory. And so very terrorism probably had more impact simply because of that. Beyond that, terrorism's impact seems to be mostly in the reaction or overreaction it causes. And this is something I've been writing a lot about over the last 10 years. In some cases, terrorism is used as an excuse for something you want to do anyway. If the assassination at Sarajevo in 1914 was a terrorist act, if you accept it as one, then you probably can in that case. It obviously didn't create World War II, but the people who wanted World War I, people who wanted that kind of conflagration used it as a convenient excuse. It might not have happened without that, at least at that point in time. And similarly, in Iraq, okay. Similarly, in Iraq, obviously 9/11 was used by people who wanted to get into a war in Iraq. And I think almost everybody would agree, without 9/11, it would not have been possible to get something going in Iraq, maybe not, and also not in Afghanistan, for that matter. So you get that way. You also get sort of the overreaction by rage. For example, the United States basically destroying the Middle East over the last 15 years with policies which have been almost entirely disastrous, with the result that over 100,000 Iraqis and other people have died, and well over about twice as many Americans have died on 9/11. So just coming out of a rage and sort of lashing back. Okay, one final point. One area where, in terms of definitions, I think it's really interesting to sort of parse out, because I think it's really substantively important, is the targeting of civilians versus military. And there's a study by Paige Fortner, which just came out recently in International Organization, in which he uses he points out the definition basically sees that all wars are terrorism. But the way she points it out basically is that if you look at insurgencies who used what she calls terrorism as a tactic versus insurgencies that don't use terrorism as a tactic, the ones that don't use terrorism do a lot better in achieving their goals. In this case, she defines terrorism as the repeated and sort of random killing of civilians. So she's got a real definition of what it means. And so some terrorist organizations avoid only hit military targets. Some hit both. And if you hit the civilian, it tends to be very bad. Similar research by Max Abrams shows a similar sort of thing, that targeting, it's very important if you're a terrorist not to target civilians, because it is a bad idea if you really want to be successful with your final goal. This does not bode very well for ISIS, I guess. Okay, I'm about to be red-carded here, and I don't want to be hauled off and thrown in the showers. So I'll stop right there, and we can kick this and me around. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. your own questions?
Sure.
Okay, cool.
Ladies first. That was really good. So I'm intrigued. So as somebody who's not a political scientist in the room, who got into this through terrorism, I'm intrigued by the tension with insurgency and terrorism, and particularly the Civil War thing. I think you had a really compelling argument. My response to that is, why not both and? I mean, I'm a statistician, criminologist, policy person. I look at trends over time. I think it's a really important issue that you're raising. And I think what might be worth doing is, I like the idea of sort of setting a threshold, but I think there's a point where instead of saying terror, because what of course will happen to the terrorism is it'll suddenly drop. you know, so why ruin one trend just to make the other happy? Why not code both, right?
Right.
I mean,
fine.
It's the spirit of the GTD. And I think it would be pretty easy, you know, looking at when does it cross the line and having do some real serious research to kind of pick some points that seem like, you know, to help by strategically identify that point and then start coding as both so
yeah,
that the civil wars can continue to be measured properly as well as what we're learning from terrorism because, you know, as I said before, you know, the people who are perpetrating these acts don't buy the definitions, right? They're just doing what they're doing for whatever reasons, and they're not looking at what box they need to fit into. And I think it's up to us to be really flexible in how we do this and deliberate with how we do this so that we're not compromising things and so that we can have the most informative analysis as possible and most flexible as we can have.
Yeah, so. Well, my issue on that would be, I very much agree, have them counted. But if you're going to count attacks by insurgents against military targets in Iraq, you'd also have to do it for wars like or against civilians as well. You have to do that for the war in Algeria and so forth, pushing it back farther.
Right, and I mean, so you've been looking at that book. if you look at it. We don't include all attacks against military as terrorism. There's those three criteria, and two of the three must be met. And one of them is outside the arena of legitimate warfare. So it's the ones that meet the other two criteria, of which I have in front of me, but I'm not going to read.
My point fits better for civilians, which everybody would agree is terrorism by your definition, right?
Right.
And so there's a lot of terrorism in that sense in the insurgency, in the civil war in Algeria.
Right.
And
oh,
so if you're
sure.
taking it back, you
For sure. And we actually have a lot of the Algerian stuff in the right. GTD.
Right.
Right.
And so you know, but what happens is that Algeria has never been called terrorism, it's always been called a civil war.
Right.
So,
we call it both.
Right. That's one way out.
So Laura took a lot of what I was going to say.
Sorry.
But I'm going to make stuff up anyway. So first of all, there are lots of people who call Algeria terrorism. I think that to focus in on one thing you said, ISIS is an insurgency, it's not a terrorist organization. And as far as I'm concerned, ISIS is both. I don't see any reason or need to see these as mutually exclusive. Hezbollah, I think, could be seen as an insurgent organization during certain periods of time. As a terrorist organization, as also a social service organization. Organizations like people can be many things, and if we use intensity as our definition of terrorism, intensity of activity as a definition of terrorism, I think we lose an enormous amount in our analysis of what distinguishes certain kinds of behavior from other kinds of behavior.
Well, yeah, my main, it's an extremely good point, of course. What you have to do is want to say you're willing to get rid of civil war as a category, and you want to call it terrorism. And the terrorism, of course, has this pejorative quality to it, why everybody wants to use it, but only selectively, of course. In Syria, the United States is fighting on the side of freedom fighters in some cases, and whereas ISIS is a terrorist group, even though they're doing the same thing.
So my response to that is I disagree. I think that you can continue with the definition of civil wars. Some civil wars are going to have terrorism in them. Some civil wars won't. Saying that something can be terrorist doesn't mean it can't also be a civil war. Saying something's a civil war doesn't necessarily mean it's terrorist.
Okay, but then what you need to work out is what do you mean when you say civil war? Some civil wars have terrorism in them. You must have a definition of terrorism, which is different from something.
UCDP has a really good definition in terms of insurgent battle deaths. So battle deaths could be used as is by many people already use it as a definition of civil wars is a certain level of battle deaths. Some people say 25, some people say 1,000. And battle deaths, killing people on the battlefield, is very different than killing them on the streets.
And so they're killing military people in that. I mean, if you kill enough, well, you're saying then if they kill enough people, in other words, to get above the 1,000 battle deaths a year or whatever.
I go with 25, but yes, yeah. People say
well,
either
25
battle deaths or, right. Or 1,000 or 100 would but, create a situation where you have two different things. One distinguishes civil war as one distinguishes terrorism.
Right. Okay, so that seems close to what I'm arguing. If it gets to a certain intensity of fighting, we no longer call it terrorism. We would call it civil war, right?
John, thanks very much. Thanks very much for that, John. Yeah. I just to say, I really enjoyed that, and I have so many things to ask, and I wouldn't know where to begin because I think it's absolutely vital to draw your conceptual parameters around these different forms of political violence, i.e., where does terrorism end and where does another form of political violence begin? And just to amplify those points, I mean, personally, I do prefer to see conceptualized terrorism as a particular method of violence. So it doesn't matter who the perpetrator is, it doesn't matter almost if it's a civil war or not. If it satisfies your criteria as to what constitutes an act of terrorism, then an act of terrorism it remains. It could be committed by a guerrilla organization, it could be committed within the civil war, and so on. And I agree with you. The Northern Ireland early 70s. I think the Northern Ireland, arguably the IRA, almost graduated into a guerrilla outfit through what was called sort of Catholic ghettos and so on. Never quite made it. It still, I think, remained at that lower level of a terrorist organization. But you also mentioned, I think, this idea, this quantitative difference between war and terrorism. I'm going to sort of stretch that a little further and introduce this other concept called political terror. Now, terror and terrorism are often used interchangeably in the literature and public discourse and so on. I prefer to draw a distinction between terrorism and political terror. And I suppose one of the best ways to do it, if hypothetically, if you look at ISIS, I would say the beheadings were deliberate acts of violence. They constitute terrorism in terms of generating a psychological impact beyond the immediate victims. I think hanging corpses up on the end of streets within the population they control, I would classify as, hypothetically, because it's a so-called state, as state terror. So I'm just wondering there, early in the piece, introduced this other concept of political terror, and I call it political rather than state, because theoretically non-states could also carry out political terror. And the qualitative distinction I would draw between that, and this is coming on to war, because of course some of war is seen as state terror, NATO bombing campaigns, shock and awe, and so on. The qualitative distinction I would draw is between being in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's fairly relatively lower level terrorist violence, and actually, for example, in the case of state terror, being under threat in your own home. There's a qualitative distinction, I think, in the nature of the fear there, where living in your own home is no, or staying in your own home is no guarantee of peace either. I just wonder whether that sort of comes into your deliberations in your work as well. Sorry, that was very long.
Yeah, I have problems with that. I really want to get down to one variable, which is how much of it happens. I mean, Genghis Khan was the world's greatest, terrorist. If you look at the medieval war, there were these long sieges, which resulted in huge numbers of civilian casualties. And so what seems to me, terrorism does exactly the same thing war does, except not very often, like the IRA. And so they're blowing it, killing people, they're breaking things, they're sometimes killing civilians, sometimes killing military. They're trying to break, and they're doing for a political purpose, which is to break the will of the opponent. That's why I want to get away from, obviously, a lot of definitions use targets and other things. And whether you're safe in your own home, I mean, I assume people are mostly calling, Syria civil war now, and people do not feel very safe in their own home. And wars, that's why you have refugees from wars more than you have from terrorism, because wars are worse than terrorism, because there's a lot, they're like terrorism, except there's a lot more of it. Anyway, this is obviously a good sort of minimalist definition to work from, and I'm not going to get total agreement by any means, but it seems to me that works. It works for me, let's put it that way. Yeah.
Oh. I wonder, no, it's more than wondering. What I care about in this debate is the psychology of the perpetrators. I want to understand how you can get normal human beings to kill women, children, old people. And at one extreme, a state that kills with a bombing campaign, say.
That's done by people, though.
Pardon?
That's done by people.
Oh, yes. No, I'm saying. Yeah. But from my point of view, the psychology of the people who are dropping bombs as part of a very large organization is quite a different psychology from that of one of Sageman's bunch of guys, some self-starting two or three guys who would take it upon themselves to start using violence. So what my stake in this is about is I think that there is a point, and I'm not ready to put a number on it either, but there is a point when you go from a very small group to a very large organization where it becomes how it happens, how these normal people get to do what they do, it becomes a matter of organizational psychology as opposed to small group dynamics or individual psychology, and that's why I want to keep some distinction.
Yeah, well, it's maybe we're on the same page on this. You'll have to tell me. What I'm saying is that at the low level, you basically have volunteers doing it for some reason, and as it gets bigger and bigger, you run into organizational problems, which ISIS is surely doing. And the most classic one is, how do you train people to fight in combat? Samuel Stauffer was dealing with that in World War II. You take ordinary people and you want them to be motivated to actually kill people. And so there's a whole psychology of that, or sociology of that. You need to, it's not that there's any real differences. Terrorists want more people in their bands, and they try to recruit people, and they encourage them with ideological things, or they try to get them. The same thing that happens with combat soldiers, namely you're in this tiny group, we happy few who are fighting this, and we're all together and fighting each other for each other and so forth. And the same psychology is probably used in both cases. The difference is, I think you're right, that the difference is that in war you have to do this on a major scale, which ISIS is unusual in the sense of, you know, among terrorist groups of being so large, if you call it a terrorist group, which I don't. But the psychology is the same. You want to get more recruits. You if you're in the IRA, you want to keep people in the organization. You want to worry about spies and saboteurs and defectors and so forth. When there's only three people on a street corner, you don't have to worry about that too much, except one was probably an FBI informant, so you're in big trouble on that. But if that's not the case, it's relatively small, but once you start getting bigger and bigger, it starts to become something different. And it becomes only different in the size, so, in my view.
I mean, once you get to a sizable organization, and I'm not an expert on the IRA, but I had the impression they had a pretty sizable organization, yeah, with multiple levels and training separate.
Right.
Anyway, so once you get to something like that, yes, the perpetrators down at the bottom level, yes, they are using the same small group dynamics horsepower as a platoon, or maybe better, a squad in combat. Yes, I agree with that. But you won't understand how that small group came to be where it is and feel like it has to do what it does when it comes to a bombing campaign. You won't understand it if you stick only to the level of the small group dynamics and the individual psychology. So, yeah. So it's going to make a difference in our explanation, our understanding. It's going to have to be considerably different when we got a sizable organization. So I do think that there is a difference for us as analysts. There is an important difference between something that you would be ready to call an insurgency, and I probably would too, and something that's an underground terrorist cell.
Okay, we'll have to agree to disagree on that. It seems to me the mechanisms are extremely similar. There's a small organization versus a big organization, unless you can argue that big organizations, they have different, bigger problems in some respects, but I think the same device is being used about camaraderie, about devotion to the cause, and so forth, and that's at the low level, and at the if you want them to not defect. So, The level, if you want to consider the IRA an insurgency, that I might be willing to do that. I have to think about it. It's just usually not considered to be, and it wasn't frequent enough. But at some point, it did get pretty frequent, as you were saying. And so maybe at some point we should call that an insurgency rather than terrorism.
So, John, it leads to a good segue. I think if you look at the IRAs, so you've got lost lives, the total number of people killed during the Troubles was 3,600. If you include wounded, you're looking at almost 18,000 people. And I think depending on who you spoke to, if you spoke to Irish Republicans, they would have called it an insurgency. So I don't want you to get bogged down in the way it's described by third parties. But here's where, and I do so only in the most gentle way, as a corrective, because I have a great fondness for you. I think the problem with the definition is that up until 1995 with the Tokyo attack, the sarin gas attack, and the introduction of apocalyptic millennial terrorism, the idea of terrorism always was to kill a few and terrorize the many. So the idea of going for the maximum number of casualties only is introduced in 1995 on. And it's adopted readily by groups, the jihadi Salafi groups, Al-Qaeda, and others. So the problem with having your litmus test be the number of people dead is the idea of that kind of terrorism only starts in 95. And so that sort of puts a little bit of a wrench into the whole argument. The issue about the randomness, and I've tried to correct Paige, but Paige doesn't listen to me, the idea of randomness doesn't take into account that randomness, if you're targeting a particular population, the Palestinians aren't just setting off a bomb in the early 2000s, weren't setting off bombs to kill just anybody. It was random only to a certain extent. There was a limitation. Daesh's, or look, AQI, was going after Shia. So, you know, it's random in the sense of it's a Shia target. You've gone to a particular mosque or a school, but you know who's there. So that's why, you know, this issue of randomness, I think, is maybe a false dichotomy. Because, yes, the people are in the wrong place at the wrong time, but they're going after a particular kind of people. And if you go in, and when I did my field research in Sri Lanka, the Tamils use terrorism as a form of target assassination as well, so that they had very specific, deliberate targets. So I think, like, I wouldn't want you to adopt the framework Paige is using, because there's an underlying problem in her definition. So that's not your issue. It was just the other things that I wanted to say about the number of casualties.
Yeah, it's just that much of what you said could be said for warfare as well. You want to minimize, you want to win with the lowest cost possible to yourself and to the other side. If it takes massive, you know, dropping a bomb on Hiroshima, you'll do it. Yeah, well, but the point is, you want the whole point about military force is you want to focus it so it does maximum damage to the other side, and the terrorists would have that same sort of calculation. So the issue is basically trying to keep keeping terrorism separate from civil warfare or maybe even international warfare, and it seems to me the main thing is just the frequency it happens. They're using the same tactics. They're trying to minimize their casualties, trying to inspire their people to kill or destroy. They may have an idea that the only way we can solve this problem is kill lots of people. They may have that if we only do a certain people, if we only kill Assad, the whole problem would be solved. And that'd be in warfare as well. If you can get the pressure point that causes the whole thing to collapse, and then you try to do it. Otherwise, or else you do carpet bombing, things like that. So.
Can we
have
5 minutes left? So we're going to take David and Michael as the last questions.
Yeah, John. Pardon? Yeah, in terms of your idea about international warfare, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense up until 1946 and the Geneva Conventions. But warfare is really supposed, or legalized warfare, is supposed to be defined under the rules of the law of war and international humanitarian law, which explicitly prohibits that. And your concept doesn't seem to distinguish between lawful execution of warfare and the unlawful one.
Yeah, the law isn't in there anywhere. Right, I agree. it's just that they're the laws of war, and you know they're constantly disobeyed by people who signed the same treaty and so forth. Also, the whole idea of having just war is a fairly recent concept, and disobeyed by the people who basically did it. I don't think there's any. It is true that warfare does have an effort to try to have a legal structure for it, and certain targets are not supposed to be hit and so forth. And terrorism doesn't have any kind of legal structure in that sense. But I would—I mostly would not use that. It seems to me it's not a major player in the difference in between the two. Since warfare so frequently, I mean, you know, you're talking economic warfare against Iraq in the 1990s. You know, Madame Albright gets on television and she's asked on 60 Minutes, Madame Albright, Madam Secretary, Madam Representative, she, the UN, she was. We've heard that the sanctions on Iraq have killed half a million children in Iraq. Do you think it's worth it? And she said, yes. That got no play in the United States, but did in the Middle East. And then Robert Gates said, as long as Saddam is in power, they are going to suffer. That's not bombing, of course, that's sanctions. And the number half a million is probably way off. But nonetheless, they're certainly willing to countenance
killing.
So you
see no difference between a set of sanctions that were put into place through a regularized process of international law through the United Nations and an action which is intended and directly is targeting a civilian population?
Yeah, well, that's right. It was not intended to kill children under five, but it did. And so that was an unintended consequence. But as Robert Gates said at the time, too bad. So I mean, that's the issue. It just seems to me it's so hypocritical in many respects. So often.
This is the end of this session. Appreciate your time, John.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.